morning, everyone. Putting this together, I thought of a different title as opposed to the government bureaucracies, and I thought about Earth, Wind, and Fire song, sing a song, but that was just a little bit too kumbaya-ish, and I didn't think that that would work. And I thought about maybe Side by Side, another Earth, Wind, and Fire song, but often when we work with communities and the government, we don't necessarily go side by side. There is some fighting that goes on.
13-5.
There you go. You're with me. I'm also showing my age as well, too, so.
You definitely are. People are going, who is Earth, Wind,
and Fire? I know. That's right, but I've got something for the younger generation here. But what my job here is to kind of play cleanup and tie all this together and really explain to you how we at CDC are looking to do the structural interventions and really impact at the governmental level, health provider level, and community level. So very quickly on the objectives, just defining the term cultural leverage. I know Joe has given you the definition for interventions, but I'm going to touch on a little bit expanded definition on what some of the work that Dr. Friedman in New York has done around interventions with injecting drug users. Describing how cultural leverage can work to design interventions and the interplay between community partners, health providers, and governmental agencies, and provide examples on structural interventions as it's laid out in our Disparities Action Plan. Like Scott, I have a tendency to talk a little on the fast side, so if I get too fast, let me know. All right, looking at cultural leverage, and this was some work taken from Dr. Fisher, Thomas Fisher at the University of Chicago, who is an assistant or associate professor in medicine, and what he really, as you can see here, focused on the importance of looking at the cultural practices, the philosophies and behaviors, and the thing that I liked most here, the environmental influences. And I know that we use the term social determinants, but when talking to communities, what the hell does that mean? And so environmental influences have more meaning, and it's a lot more relevant to communities. And I'm just going to digress just a little bit. I know I'm on the timer here, but I'm going to digress just a little bit and talk about what some of those environmental influences, and I know Roxanne touched upon some, but as it pertains to African Americans, I want to just kind of dig a little bit deeper here. And one of the things as far as environmental influence is the music. And I know that we've had this whole knock on hip-hop and misogyny and all of that, but I don't know how many of you actually pay attention and listen to the lyrics. I know I do. Because I do like hip-hop, not all of it, but there's some. But what I want you to, I'm going to share with you is some of the songs that are out there and why it's important for you to really listen to hip-hop. 50 Cent now has a song out, Baby By Me. Have you heard that song? I know. Okay, where he goes on here and he talks about, be a millionaire, have a baby by me. I'm going to play no games when I'm in that thing. Okay? That's an environmental influence. Aaron Hall has a song out, All the Places I Will Kiss You. There are so many places I want to kiss you, baby. I cannot begin to start. I realize that I'm not the only man that made love to you. R. Kelly, Kiss Your Candy Time. Girl, I want to kiss your candy. You got the club on pause in your real tight jeans. Young Jeezy, Bedrock. Basically want to rock the bed. And on the way home last night, I was listening to Bedrock. My goodness. Also, if you look at just the top Billboard songs as of last week, the number one Billboard song was by Robin Thicke, Sex Therapy. I'm just going to give you some of the top 100 iTunes, just very quickly. Ludacris, How Low. Now, that's a real interesting song that you might want to listen to. That's number three. Number five, also by Ludacris, My Chick Bad. Woo! Number six, New Boys featuring Ray J, Tie Me Down. And then Roscoe Dash with All the Way Turned Up. Again, it is important that you take the time out and listen to the lyrics, understand what some of the environmental influences that are impacting the youth and communities today. Other important environmental influences: incarceration rates for black men. The Human Rights Watch in the U.S., and it's an old Richard Pryor stand-up, it's just us in these prisons, meaning black folk. The incarceration rate for African Americans is roughly, for black males, 4,300 per 100,000. 4,300 per 100,000. So basically, 1 in 9 black men on lockdown. And just to give you a very quick idea here of what we're looking at in some of our male incarceration rates, D.C., almost 7,900 per 100,000. Texas, where Joe and I are from, and we love to lock up folks, in Texas, almost 7,300 per 100,000. Georgia, in this great state, the Peach State, 3,400 per 100,000. North Carolina, almost 3,700 per 100,000 for African Americans, males. And so again, environmental influences that we need to be cognizant of. Another environmental influence: rates of unemployment for African American males. That's also important. Roughly about 16%. When you start looking at younger populations, it's much higher for African American males. When you look at high school dropout rates for young boys, we, on average, roughly about 50% of our African American males, we graduate. 50% nationally. There are 17 states that don't even get to 50%. For example, the great state of Georgia, 40%. Illinois, 40%. New York, 39%. Florida, 38%. So, with all that said, as far as environmental influences, what are we doing for men, black men? This is an environmental influence that is really, in my opinion, and there are some reports out that speak to how this is driving the disparities among African Americans. All too often, we put the burden on women. We screen women, we encourage women to have access to care and all of that, but unfortunately, she's going back to a different environment. And where you've got now, you've got brothers on lockdown, and so that limits the number of men, successful men, that a sister can choose from. And so here we are, we screen the woman, we screen her, she gets treated, all right, 3 months, we're screening her again, she's got the disease again. And so again, important that we understand the balance on the environmental influences that impact African-American populations as well as other populations that have disproportionate burdens of disease. Interventions, and Scott and Dazon did a very nice job of outlining the importance of really working with communities to design and drive the interventions. And this is why it's intervention, because it's coming from the bottom up. And it's important that we really work very closely with affected communities and help them, or actually have them teach us on what works in those communities. And that's why it's an ongoing balance. Here in designing intervention through cultural leverage, and this was work from a professor out of the Center for AIDS Prevention Studies in California, and laid out very nicely here what Scott and Dazon have touched upon, where we relate the intervention to undeniable needs that bring satisfaction, we implement in a social setting, and as you heard both of them talk about the importance of social settings, social networks, develop peer-based interventions. Again, not me as a 52-year-old man trying to talk to a young 20-something or 15-year-old kid, but having peers, somebody they can relate to, really working with them. Using peer norms to affect change. Having community members design and implement the interventions. Again, it's got to be community driven. Actually, it's got to be neighborhood driven. And then facilitate feedback, as you heard both Scott and Dazon talk about the importance of feedback. That is critical. Here, just to give you an idea on some of the interplay that would exist with communities, healthcare providers, and governmental agencies. As you can see here, again, Scott and Dazon touched upon that, working with community partners, an opportunity to educate in relation to disparities, to identify and understand social networks, as they talked about already, and then crafting those cultural-specific STD prevention messages. With healthcare providers, some work that we, in collaboration with the Division of HIV/AIDS, is working with healthcare providers to have them become more versed about racial disparities, increase their knowledge around sexual health, and then provide cultural-specific care. Just the simple thing of trying to take a better sexual history and working with the National Medical Association in doing that kind of work. And looking at the governmental agencies there and informing communities about racial disparities, as you can see here, actively engaging communities is critical. Let me quickly go through this on what we're doing here around our action plan as it relates to these groups as I've just laid out here. As an example here, where the objective there in promoting information exchange among public health professionals and community stakeholders, one of the things is that we did two consultations with external stakeholders to address specific issues around African-American males, and really had some concerns as they brought to us about the stigma around homophobia and racism. Also in engaging community partners here and conducting focus groups in Dallas, Chicago, and Alexandria, Virginia, to get their feedback on how we can design better messages that will be more impactful. Healthcare providers, I alluded to already on the DHAP and our division connection with NMA, and the pilot test, as you can see there, that's going on in 10 U.S. cities. Governmental agencies, what we're doing, as Dazon kind of shared, with the work that we're doing around some of the curriculum development at the undergraduate and graduate school level. We also have a project with the medical schools to impact and help in a standardized approach to STI curriculum development at the medical school level. Oh, I'm doing my time. Okay. This is my last slot. Never allow a person to tell you no who doesn't have the power to say yes. And by Eleanor Roosevelt, and all too often, what we have done is we say, no, that won't work, this won't work in certain communities, but we don't have the power to say yes, what can work. That's the community, and that's individuals within the community. So again, never allow a person to tell you no who doesn't have the power to say yes. Thank you.
Thank you. So now, if you want to stretch a little bit while we turn our chairs around so that we can do some Q&A. And we don't have a lot of, actually we only have one mic. So what we're going to have to ask everyone to do is speak up really loudly and clearly so everyone can hear you.
Or we can do that too.
And I'll stay up here in case I need to repeat for people so that they can hear. So coming to the front now, we have Shane Johnson, who is in our program and training branch. And as I said, he, like David, is a member of the NCHSTP, or the National Center for HIV, STD, I'm sorry, National Center for HIV, Herpes, Viral Herpes, STD, and TB Prevention. And Shane and David have been working on that MSM work group. So, because Leo wasn't able to join us today, and we thought we wanted to make sure we had a good perspective to talk about the various issues associated with the MSM issues, and Shane has done quite a bit of work in that area, I thought it would be really helpful if he could join us for this discussion. But as the moderator, I was assigned previously to ask hard questions of the panelists, and I don't know if they remember that I was supposed to do that. Do you remember that? Well, I'm going to go ahead. You were hoping I forgot. So, you know, I think probably I'm going to see if the audience has, you know, want to start with their own questions, and I will reserve that. And in case I have to pull that, I want you to know I did pay attention and have my hard questions. So, it's open to the floor, and let's go ahead and get started. Yes,
well,
sir.
I have actually many questions for the panel, those people who did speak, but I was looking forward to the presentation on MSM, so I would like to hear if you have some observations about that. The way that factors in.
What Leo was going to speak to is that there have been a number of studies around MSM, and particularly among African American MSM. But the problem has been that it's been very limited, and it hasn't taken into consideration in some of the social factors that I alluded to earlier, and the homophobia and the racism. The other thing, as I laid out some of these environmental influences, and I should have added in my discussion with Leo that I was supposed to, and I didn't, and I apologize. But where can, when you look at some of these environmental influences, where can a young man that is really troubled about their sexuality, is there a healthy and a safe place to go? There really isn't. There isn't even really a safe place to go for a young African-American male that's even trying to be in a heterosexual relationship. And so that is the thing that Leo is working with, and he's also part of the Black Gay Research Group, and that is their focus on these young men that are questioning where they are in their whole sexuality, especially for men of color. We need to identify places that they can go and that's safe, where they're not put in a position of really being exploited. And that's all too often now what the case is now for a number of young men of color that are really troubled about where they are in that whole sexuality spectrum.
And Lezon, you were going to add?
Yeah, and as a sex man, no, I'm just kidding. what I'm hopeful for, which is where my thinking comes in terms of what David was talking about, I've been in a lot of spaces having this conversation, because from the broader perspective of, and this is primarily focusing on our young MSMs, right, our youth, and there are two environmental influences there that are either one, we've just been absolutely shut out from, or two, we haven't figured out how to penetrate. One is the education system, and the other one is family. And so there's a particular study that Caitlin Ryan has been in charge of, has been the PI for out at San Francisco UCSF, called the Family Acceptance Project. And what I've been looking for, or communicating with, especially within the Black Gay Research grouping, is how do we look at that particular study, which was conducted in Oakland, primarily with Latino and white families, and translate that or transfer that into Black communities to focus in on, with working at a community-based participatory research project, to focus on families' attitudes and behaviors towards their own gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans youth. Because that study, if you haven't, you should go online and read the papers and look at the intervention work that they're just now undertaking. But the core of the homophobia and the as a social determinant and as a barrier to everything, education, care, equality, the whole nine, that homophobia really, just like racism, it starts right there in your own home. And if we have parents that reach a certain level of acceptability and social acceptance, then they will work more with their schools to increase access. They'll work more within the other systems of care and service delivery. You won't have parents demanding that you don't talk about gay sex in my schools because my kid is in that school. And so I love my child. And so I'm really wanting us to do more around family acceptance, especially of our young men, because you know, they end up on the streets at even greater risk simply because the families aren't there.
Other questions? Yes.
I work within the Gainesville District, which is 13 counties, and most of them are rural and very conservative. And so we run youth and young adult programs, and it is so hard to advocate for what people call And when we're dealing with STDs and gonorrhea and MSMs or whatever, that population is very marginalized and people do not want to fund that on any level. How do we tap in, what other resources besides state and really local government can we use, especially with men's health? I have a think program for boys within the school system and it's unfunded. And we're really like, the advisory board is like taking money out of their pocket to fund the program. Where do we tap into that? And also with Sister Love, how do we replicate that into the more rural counties who are still, you know, not ready for that, those conversations? Thank you.
Which one of our panel went out?
I know that was a lot good.
Extremely resource poor situation. So I was wondering if you had a comment you wanted to respond, Scott.
Sure.
It's dangerous having the moderator behind you.
I mean, it's certainly a different population, but I think there are a lot of the same sort of community issues. Yeah. And really trying to find where do you plug in and how do you get that message out? In any country, I think we often have to find champions to really to be that voice for the community because it is so targeted and it is stigmatizing to begin to point out we need to be doing something with X, Y, or Z. And a lot of the small communities are very closed-minded, very protective of the folks that live there. So it's trying to find a champion, be that an elder, be that a school system, be whatever, but you need to have a foot in the door in order to have an impact and have some sustainability. Because it doesn't go very far for me to come into a community and say, we need to try to do this. It's really to have the community have some ownership in trying to do something better for the population and trying to support that long term. Because if you only do something short term, you know, an intervention and walk away, often the wheels fall off and you don't really have a long-term impact.
Two things that are quick. First of all, the intervention itself is working its way through the pipeline of becoming an EBI. I don't know about a Debbie, but we're certainly becoming an EBI and going into the national compendium. And so we're currently working on the enhancement of that and how to frame it into a toolkit. Can't give you a timeline on that because I'm working on the money too. But that's one. But the other thing that you talk about, first of all, I can tell you that it's also about those relationships and those champions, because I can tell you, we've been doing Healthy Love parties in Fort Valley, Macon, Augusta, you know, down at Tipton and outside Savannah and all these different kinds of places, because there are people there who say, yeah, we can use that, bring it in. Now, they might be catching all kinds of flack at the local level, but they're willing to put themselves on that line, and so we're willing to work with them however we have to do that, even if we have to leave condoms in the car. Sometimes that happens. But then, if they want us to mail them to the kids, we will. So mail them to us so we can distribute them, that's what I mean. But what you mentioned, I think, which is really important from a systemic level, because this is another part of the conversation, is that in a lot of places, the only place people can access is the health department, and that's the problem. So if there were other places that were delivering similar services and care that people had more comfort, more protection, they had a different sense of confidentiality, they had a different sense of trust, even if that particular entity was actually being subcontracted by the health department. That's not what matters. What matters is that it's not the health department, and that's what I think CDC and other public health institutions have to grapple with, is that they've got to expand beyond that very linear relationship that they have with the health department.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, Scott.
I'm from Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's very obvious that young people are coming out expressing their sexuality or their sex preference much earlier, which in my opinion is an indication for health. However, when you're dealing with school systems, which you've got an 80% African enrollment in one and 80% non-African American in the other. The majority of the kids that my experience is with is African American. How do you bring the subject up and even begin support groups for these kids? We have an HBCU that does not have a gay and lesbian organization, and of course the university does have one. So these kids have got to wait, if they get to college, before they can really gain the knowledge they need that affect their decisions. So by the time they leave high school, many of them have already been infected with HIV and other diseases. So how do you begin the process at the grassroots level of getting the community to identify or accept the fact that, hey, we've got some issues here that we need to address now before it gets too late?
Yeah, I think that as opposed to just hammering the acceptability issue around homosexuality, you might want to start with having a discussion about sexual health and sexuality. And so that way it doesn't get into this issue of I need you to be accept gay youth, but have that discussion, and really it will allow you an opportunity to, what are people's sensitive issues around sexual health and sexuality? And an opportunity for the community to share with you how that can be approached. I think that can be a start, and that would be an opportunity for you then to talk about how you have youth coming to you that are troubled or questioned about their sexuality, and how we can put them in a better position to be healthy about their decisions and choices they make.
Yeah, and you can also work with your local CBOs and work with the community-based organizations in your area and partner with them to provide support groups.
Yes, in the back.
I have a question, and this is for Deza and others. I think it's a very important thing that you raised about trying to address black families in terms of homophobia and internal attitudes of beliefs about that. But as a co-developer of Many, Many, Many Voices, which obviously you're familiar with, which is was an intervention, I can't tell you how much we heard about the black churches.
Yes.
And really almost more powerful in terms of homophobia, and the number of black men who, you know, revealed this long-standing experience of having been called an abomination in church, and sort of the idea that that was influencing also their family's internal attitude, as well as attitudes in the community. So I wondered if anybody had some familiarity with anything effective working around black churches around the homophobia issue.
Moderate and start.
Just
a couple of things. I mean, you know, we sort of have a notion about the black church, and I think we sort of, many times, as an institution, the CDC remembers it and thinks of it in terms of the Martin Luther King marches and the civil rights movement. And one of the things we try to stress to our colleagues, who can sometimes be a little naive about the role of the black church, is that while you might have a very liberal political body, you may have a very socially conservative body. And one of the things I always say to people, now would you ask, you know, somebody in Jerry Falwell's church to talk about sex from the pulpit? And that's not really a feasible kind of a strategy. So what I always try to remind people is that churches are as different as people are. And so you can't just sort of think of the black church as a monolith, the same way we might even think of the black community as a monolith, and that you have to actually find those progressive pastors and progressive churches who are ready, willing, and able to do that, and that's not everybody all the time. And sometimes we sort of forget that the political side is not the same as the social side. I saw that in the 90s when we were working with, you know, at the time crack epidemics were really high, and we had a lot of syphilis associated with crack use. And so people kept saying, we've got to go to the churches, we've got to get the churches involved, and I said, you know, I've done a lot of needs assessment and formative work, and not one time has a drug addicted person told me that I went to church information about what to do about my sexual behavior. So, you know, I can say, if you're talking about truly an intervention that's truly about the community that's affected, you have to look at how that population is received in those settings and listen to them. They will tell you who those people are. And just keep in mind that all these folks and all these institutions differ from place to place. Some of the most progressive and forward-thinking and activist churches I've seen partners who does things that even the government wasn't willing to do.
Right.
But there are others who are also marching against the civil rights of these same groups. And so you have to just remember that one size will not fit all.
Right.
Okay, now I gotta try to remember my order because I think Gwen's hand was up, then Michael's, and then here, and then here. And then I don't know if the panel wanted to address the church issue further.
Well, I had this dream the other night that there's, you know how there's, you know, literally, it really happened. You know that move your money campaign that's going on where you move your money from the big banks to your community banks? I literally had this campaign dream of move your prayer from the big mega monopoly, you know, prosperity, you all going to hell churches, to the progressive churches where we are getting a lot of work done and are delivering care and service. Because the mental health component that's connected to our spiritual health is critical. And so they might not tell you that they went to church. That's because the last time they were there, they were basically ignored or kicked out. And so that's a big issue about it. But particularly around homophobia, with those progressives, with those, there are a lot of LGBT faith-based institutions that now exist, and they work in partnership with some of the larger progressive faith institutions. What we don't do that have been, you know, scorned for years, we've got all of these bumps on our heads from beating ourselves up against that, you know, wall, is that for those who are doing that amazing stuff, we're not lifting them up because we keep putting them in that monolith. We're not using them in the best way that we can in all of our spaces. We're not recognizing at the level that we should that that is happening and that we do have faith leaders. When I stood here and talked with Tony Wafer and the pastors that he represents from the National Action Network are huge names who sit on the side of doing the right thing by people at risk. Those are the folks we have to lift up and really use and shame the others, honestly, if they're doing. And then I'm not, you know, I'm a happy heathen who prays. So, I can't talk about what happens inside the church. But what I know is the hypocrisy within inside the church is also what drives people away. Because there are women who know that they have been approached, that they have been hit on, or that they are actually in affairs with their pastors who are also having sex with men. Right. So, but they're not, so they're never going to address it because they might end up, you know, being like this guy out of California who had to come clean this week.
My question is regarding taking ownership of the problem. We understand, coming from the health department side, that it's the community that needs to take ownership and will be most effective in developing any intervention or intervention to address these problems. So what we try to do is bring the information, sit down and have dialogue, but that does not seem to even motivate some of the leaders in the community to take ownership of the problem. The question is there any one strategy or something that we could use to help motivate the communities to begin to take ownership?
Yeah, I think one of the problems that we have is that we look for a leader in some of these communities, and I think that's the wrong approach. Because there are no kind of Joe's point, because when there are issues with other communities, we don't go and try to find a white man. We go to neighborhoods and talk to people about the issues and problems, and organically, things come up on how best to approach. One of the things, again, in laying out some of the environmental influences, and I remember when I worked in Miami, another guy and I, and this was way before outreach, street outreach was popular, we would go into places where they were selling crack. And this, we'd be hanging out midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, just talking to brothers out there slinging drugs. And having a conversation with them about what they do, how they do it, why they do it. And what happened was we built up a following in this group. And so it takes time. is really what it's going to be. And I think, again, the worst thing you can do is go out and look for a leader, because that may not be who the community is identifying as a leader.
Roxanne, you wanted to?
Yes, I just wanted to add to what David was sharing. Also looking at other non-traditional, already organized type places. So it doesn't have to be a formal presentation to some, you know, fancy community group. While you're sitting there getting your hair done at your beauty salon, that's when you can start, you know, talking to the one under the dryer or the beauty salon owner and start to have those sorts of conversations in safe places, but places where people come together and they talk, and they talk about a lot of stuff in the beauty salon, the barber shops, even at other type of sporting activities. You can be the voice, and you can do it in very comfortable settings, your routine type of activities. You can just, when you're at the basketball game with your son, you can start talking to the parents or what have you in an informal way, and that might spark someone to say, you know, we need to do something about it. So that's how sometimes things can come up from the grassroots.
Because it's Michael and Deborah, and I think you had your hand out. And so I handed it back, and I'll come back to you, Rose. So I'm going to try to do the right order here. Michael.
Yeah, when I initially raised my hand, it was kind of addressed the question about lady who had the question about the community and how to get government agency involved. And I think that was answered. That's the question, that's the answer. It's at the community level, and it doesn't have to be a formal approach. Like you said, you know, we can go in and meet people where they are, where they're comfortable at. I mean, we have a mobile clinic where we go out into neighborhoods where the people are. They don't have to come to our health department. And we have a lot more success there because people are comfortable coming in. And with the churches, just to mention, you're right, it's not a monolithic, it's not, everybody's not the same, but we do have to build on those successes we do have. You know, a couple of churches in Houston where we go out and test, we actually test people Sunday after the services for HIV. We're talking about high risk, low risk, the whole congregation. And people bought into that and they feel comfortable with that. So we have to sell that story to others so that we can, you know, get to the point where this is like commonplace.
My comment was also dealing with churches. I think each of us have to be our own advocates. And I say that because in the church that I belong to, I mean, we're our health ministry. And it encompasses a whole lot of things. I have an emergency response team where I utilize the doctors and nurses, emergency responders in our church to respond. But then I also have a health education component, which I don't only talk about STD-HIV, but I slip it in there. I talk about diabetes, I talk about hepatitis, I talk about hypertension, I talk about cancer. So on my little table, I post up, this is the theme that we're going to have, talk about. But when it's time for STD-HIV, I post up rape, health disparities, where all the local resources are to go get tested. During the women's meetings that they have, I ask for 10 minutes, talk to the mothers about their children. These are the rates for STDs in our teens. And they definitely want to come up to you afterwards and talk to you about, okay, how do I start the conversation? What do I do? But the bottom line is that we have to be our own advocate in the places where we have access to. So when you're talking about changing a culture, changing a mindset, when people see that you're serious about helping your community, I mean, they stop short of allowing me to bring condoms in, but I do have condoms in my little cabinet, so if parents come up and ask me about them, you know, here's a little bag with some condoms. I'm not asking any questions about what you're going to do with them, but at least they are available. I can't openly put them on the table within in a cookie jar to have people take them, but at least they are available. But again, we have to be our own advocates in the places that we have access to.
I'm from Kansas City, and I wanted to touch bases with the churches as well. We have two important sets to do. During the first week of March, we have a national week of prayer for the Living and Exciting in Haiti. And what they allow us to do, they allow us to come in and get the educational piece about preventative measures of how not to contract them and also to do testing. But what we do is we lead up to that prior to with TIPS, which is taking it to the pews, which is a kickoff, which basically engages the church where they're in the pulpit and they're talking and leading it up to the actual event. So it is working there. Yes, of course, it is still a challenge, and we are bringing it in. We're dealing with the MSM population and we're dealing with the youth. Yes, it's been 10 years plus, and we're just now getting to the point that we have now probably two churches as opposed to just one church. You know, I'm exaggerating, but we have a lot more, but it's 10 years in the making. Yes, it's just the progression of just getting the word and putting it out there and making, as you stated, having a community and a church that's already doing it and just adding on to it.
And being persistent in the relationship.
Correct, correct.
Yes, in fact.
Now, I had a statement concerning like barbershops. I constantly community have a living community, and I go to barbershops and they know what I do. I'm a laboratory and I test. And so, what is this and what is this? And I spend an extra 2 hours in the barbershop discussing, yeah, well, this is this and this is this. I bring the atlas that we developed and said, you know, this is your penis, this is your penis on gonorrhea. Now, the problem you have with barbershop is the homophobia. You definitely have that, but going away from a church aspect, because you go to church and, you know, you hold it down, you don't want to tell your pastor that you do these things, but in barbershop, the majority of time, it's open, it's vulgar, but it's also a very open, these diseases, you know, these are the rates. At least in Atlanta, I know that I said, like I said, if I go 10-minute haircut, it's like an hour and a half because, hey, what about this? What have you seen this? And what have you seen this? So
it's a social setting.
It's a social setting. And church is a little difficult, and, you know, being a minority in the church is very hard. But in the barbershop aspect, you can go and just be, well, I won't say yourself because you never want to be yourself, but.
One of the things that we can start trying that HIV has done a good job of is tapping into social networks. Tapping into social networks. So, for example, the Ball community is very big in certain areas. So
can you talk about the Ball community for people who might not know?
the Ball community is very, very big. It's in Atlanta, New York, Philadelphia, and Detroit, San Francisco. So what you want to do is you want to tap into those areas. So wherever you can reach people. The Ball community is almost like, I don't want to say fraternity sorority, where you have gay men or MSM actually get together and perform and have these houses. And so
I got an analogy. Mardi Gras is organized in crews, right? Yeah. And all of these crews have their identity, they have their specific culture, their popularity, and their own name. They have a king or a leader, right? And they get all these creativities together and they celebrate their expression.
Yes.
Right.
The House and Ball community, it's a family social order. Where, and it's mostly young men who identify with an elder who's like, you know, I've been where you are, and this is a totally acceptable place for you to be whoever it is you're going to be, and we're going to party about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically.
Right. And I know that there's been work by both Drs. Arnold and Bailey around activities in the House Ball and interventions in House Ball, where you've got fathers of House Balls that are directing and encouraging their children in these houses to go to school. Some of the fathers are even paying for them to go to college. Find
a very
job.
Supportive network.
It's a very supportive, and you've got mothers in the houses talking to their children about using condoms, really knowing about their partners before they engage in sexual activity. And so, as Joe said, it's very supportive, and those are the interventions from the work that Arnold and Bailey have done that tap into how we can work with households to really do some very effective interventions around HIV.
So, Verley, and then I'll come back to you. Verley?
I guess I'm from Alabama. I've been working in STD over half my life. So, someone to recognize what is a heterosexual male and the need for something to help educate them about their sexual health. Because everything that kids hear is women and MSMs. But never, ever anything that I've seen, is there anything in model anywhere out there that deals with heterosexual males that we can use for heterosexual males in particularly in the black community, because it's like they're a forgotten group and we need to start young with them.
Well, I mean, I think that this is where we're working with Dazon and Sister Love to do just that, to tap into that, because you're right, it is an often forgotten group all too often, and like I said, and again, this is just my opinion, I think collectively we're more comfortable dealing with women than we are with young black men. And
you give me your card so I can find out what you're doing.
Now, let me just also add quickly too that, you know, there are other ways to think about it, not just about what the division is doing, but think about Planned Parenthood, which does look at issues around male responsibility and sexuality as somebody that might be a very important model. I see your hand. So there are other, don't just think only, you know, this center, but think more broadly about the people who are really interacting with men. And I have a young woman back here, whose name I cannot see.
Angelica.
Okay. Because you had your hand up a long time.
I just wanted to say, you made a comment really out of my mouth that it's so important to discuss African American men's health because they are the forgotten population in so many arenas. And my other comment was addressing going out into the community. One thing that has been mentioned is to be honest. Be absolutely open and honest with what you're doing, your approach, your purpose, your goal, your mission, because there are so many cultural stigmas that come from our community and public health in general. And basically, to be honest and straightforward.
Here and then back at
I just wanted to mention when you were talking about house calls, it's a little old, but there's a movie called Paris is Burning, and that is a good one to get an idea about.
The voguing and all of that.
Yes, and the ball community has gone past. Yeah. If I want to say pass it, but it's a really good movie to give you some concept of the culture.
Right. I'm sorry, I have two hands back here. I don't know who was first. And there's another hand. Okay.
Well, okay. So I just wanted to speak to the importance of collaboration with other federal partners. I mean, you mentioned Planned Parenthood, but I'm here representing Family Planning in the Title 10 program.
Right.
And frankly, I want to make a shameless plug for a conference that
this is too late. Thank you. Okay, thanks, man.
I just wanted to mention the annex and the
response about the sexually transmitted HIV, because I'm from this business of the AIDS assessment center. And we did find a study that passed on men that's just out there, they're doing the work now, looking particularly at transmission of HIV in heterosexually active African American men. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of it is to, there's an informative piece, doing focus groups with men in three different areas. Two sites in London, New York, one in North Carolina, one is a street outreach, the second one is barbershop, the third one is at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, where they're looking at a campus population. Mm-hmm. So they are doing the focus groups and in-depth interviews, brief risk assessments, those men are going to design the intervention, use those data to design the intervention in phase one. In phase two, they're going to develop it into a pilot test. Had it not been for OMB, we would probably be out and ready to go right now. But the phase one has been completed, and we're waiting on OMB approval to do phase two. So it'll be something that's available for heterosexually active.
I'll have to come back to you, but there's another hand over here. Yes.
My question, Cheryl, you from Los Angeles, David. The messages that are being developed for young MSM. I'm working with the house ball community in Los Angeles, and they're asking the question, what is CDC doing?
Well, one of the things that we do have and initiated a relationship with the National Black Gay Men's Advocacy Coalition. And so we've now been in that relationship for a couple of years. And I also mentioned we have expanded that relationship now with the the Gay Men's Research Group. And so one of the things, or two of the things that we're doing is, as Dazan has mentioned, we're looking at working with groups we haven't worked with before and having them help us better or actually design interventions that can be more impactful on that population. So we realize we don't have all of that expertise, but there are groups out there that do have that expertise, and we're working with them now.
And we're really excited because they've come to us. So.
Right.
Me? Yes.
Okay. I'm Rick, and I'm from Alabama, and I've been doing training for 26 years. And what I've heard from all of this is, and this is what I use in my training, think beyond the box. Go outside. I mean, we get so hung up, oh, it's HIV, so, you know, think beyond the box. I've been around a long time, just like this young lady right here, and it all comes down to communication. If you don't talk about it, how the hell are you going to do anything? That's what I say to the groups that have seven states. And it's really so simple, but we get so hung up on these formulas. And I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying, why not start off with something nice and simple? And last thing is, we're guilty of this, and by we, I mean our federally funded programs, our state funded programs. Many times we send so many mixed messages. You know how, because I hear it from clients, they said, 2 years ago you told me blah, 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 now you're telling me not to do that. Screw you. And they either walk out. Or they just, it's harder to get back with them. But y'all, just get back to the basics sometimes.
Final question.
No, I just wanted to add that there is a Debbie, not that all of us are Debbie fans, or maybe any of us are, but there's a Debbie coming up to design an evidence-based for heterosexual black men called NEA. And it's in the new program announcement from the Director of CBOs. So it's just an FYI, the training will probably be available this year.
So now I'm going to ask my panelists to have their final SOCO points. I'm going to start with you, Roxanne, from behind you. What's your main take-home message today?
Main message is, again, I think what the gentleman said, we can't do it all by ourselves at CDC. We really need everyone to help work on these STD disparities. So talk about it. As the young lady said in the back, you have to be honest about it. If you need information, we're available to provide that information, but I think the first place we have to start is to talk about it and be honest about the information we have and what we are hoping to accomplish.
Scott, your final SOCO, what's your take home?
You know, very similar to that. I think a lot of the discussion is really empowering folks from the ground up with information. I mean, I think that we can't really have can't force change until that will comes from the ground up and really forces folks at a higher level to really address the needs of the community themselves. And I think in order to have a sustainable impact, I think the community itself really needs to rise up and say, this is a need for our community. How can you help us? How can we try to make change?
Days on.
So I think what you were just saying is really powerful, and I have sort of this working framework that I can let folks along with. Alliteration is really powerful. So imagination, inclusion, innovation, and integration. I mean, if you had a framework where you freed yourself to create and work with communities within that frame of imagination, inclusion, innovation, and integration, you will find the solutions right where the people are living them every day.
Thank you. Shane.
In working with African American Emerson, trying to get someone who's dedicated to the cause, as opposed to just putting anyone in there to do the work, or to fill a spot. Because if they're not dedicated to the cause, then they're not going to do a good job, and they will realize that they just did a good job. So, I'm going to do something.
And David.
Bring it
home.
We cannot continue to, and I'm going to have to kind of disagree with you a little bit, Michael, have mobile screen the answer. We have to look at a different way to work with affected communities. And it can't be having a pee in a cup or draw blood on a corn as the answer. It has to be letting those communities tell us what works best. And we haven't done a very good job of that. We haven't been very consistent about that. And it goes to your point about sending the mixed messages. When we have communities tell us, we minimize the possibility of sending mixed messages. And we don't set up false expectations of, I'm coming out with the mobile unit today, but I won't be there next week or next year. And so it can't be about peeing in a cup.
Okay.